This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Today, we're talking to a panel of health experts about the COVID-19 pandemic to get updates on how Indiana is doing right now. We'll also get more details on contact tracing and vaccine distribution. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. You just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It is called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by three guests. We have first Shandy Durth, a lecturer and also the director of undergraduate epidemiology education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Hi, Shandy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We also have John Agley, associate professor at the University School of Public Health at IU Bloomington. Hello, John.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Cynthia Brown is an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Hello, Cynthia.
Thank you for asking me back. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Thank you all for being here today. We have a lot to talk about. And Shandy, I want to go to you first. This is really kind of a broad question, but I think it's always worth checking in. I guess, how are we doing in the state right now? And how has the last month gone?
So right now we are improving. Things are trending in the direction we want them to be in. So we're seeing fewer cases, we're seeing fewer hospitalizations and fewer deaths, which is great because we did see those spikes after the holidays. And so we were very happy to see the numbers trending in the right direction.
Right. Well, those spikes were to be expected, especially since we had the holidays, like you mentioned, Thanksgiving and Christmas. So there was that spike that was expected. Though we do seem to still be getting, obviously positive cases.
Correct. And so that still emphasizes the need for mask use, social distancing. We're not out of the woods yet. I've heard the phrase vaccine euphoria. And so even though we're very excited to have the vaccines and it's a great gift and we need to use these vaccines and take them when eligible, we still need to follow the other public health practices because it's going to be a while before everyone's vaccinated.
And I do want to get to a question that we had from a listener, and I'll pass that on to you, Shandy. And they ask, what do you think deserves focus and attention as this virus continues to affect our lives?
So I think we, again, need to focus on mask use. We can't get lax about that. We need to stick to some of the science that we've learned in these last few months, what works, and not just rely on vaccine. And we need to make sure that we're still following those practices until we have more people vaccinated. Even if I'm vaccinated myself, I need to follow those practices because we still have to learn whether or not being vaccinated prevents you from transmitting to other people, even if you're not sick yourself.
Right. So you definitely still need to take all those precautions, like you mentioned, wearing your face mask and washing the hands. Like you mentioned before, we're not out of the woods yet.
Correct.
John, can you tell us, I think this is interesting, what you put together, a new research paper, and I want to ask you a little bit more detail on that paper, and what did you find out?
Well, it's a broad question. Mm-hmm. There were a couple things that we found out that I thought were particularly interesting. The first thing is as part of the study, we asked people about how believable they found different narratives that we wrote. And these were narratives that were taken from other sources online that were, you know, Cornell University, for example, had a list of the top 10 most common pieces of misinformation about COVID. And so they were drawn from there. And we looked at things like the rollout of 5G cell phone networks, the idea that Bill Gates caused COVID-19 in order to expand his vaccination programs or implant microchips or something like that. And so we asked people to respond to how believable those things were, as well as one statement that is the current scientific consensus, which is that it's a zoonotic origin for the virus, so that it would, you know, originate in animals and through some mechanism spread to people. And so we found that there were actually these what are called latent profiles. So we were able to group people into clusters based on the way that they responded to how believable this stuff was. And there was one group that generally believed the zoonotic story about, you know, the origin from animals, and generally disbelieved the other narratives. But there were other groups that believed the misinformation narratives to greater or lesser degrees. And the surprise to me in all that was the fact that believing in misinformation didn't seem to really affect whether people also believed or thought that the scientific consensus explanation was believable. That is, that it's not, you know, misinformation was not disbelieving the idea that it could have come from a bat. It was rather believing that many additional things were also plausible. I hope that's clear.
That's a little confusing. Can you be a little more specific as far as what do you think people do actually believe?
So, well, we found that actually, at least in this sample, about 70% of people who responded to our survey generally said that the virus was likely to have originated in animals and spread to humans, which is that narrative that is based on the scientific studies. But there were 30% of people who thought that certain things were actually quite believable that we know not to be true, like that, you know, the 5G cell phone networks do not cause the spread of COVID-19, but people felt strongly enough about that. Not only have they found it believable, but in certain places in the world, people have gone so far as to burn down 5G cell phone towers. Mm. So this is not an abstract belief. You know, this is a fairly strong belief in that possibility.
Right.
Like I said, the most prolific conspiracy theory about COVID right when the lockdowns began in the U.S., the one that was discussed most often on social media was actually one related to Bill Gates. But there are others, you know, there are theories about it having been developed as a military weapon, that it's not real, that it's no more dangerous than the flu, but the risks are being exaggerated. And all these things can be shown to be misleading, but, people to a greater or lesser degree, at least 30% of the people in our sample thought that those were still plausible explanations.
It seems like you always have like two groups, right? You have one group of people who believe in science. Everything they believe, they base it on science. And then you have the other half who they don't believe anything in science. Is it difficult to measure between the two?
Yeah, I think the reason it's difficult to measure, I think, and this is a hypothesis, is that I think it's probably a little more complex than just believing in science and not believing in science. And that's where the trust element came in. We asked people a lot about the degree to which they trusted science, and trust is, you know, as you know from just dealing with people, trust is really complicated. Trust requires that the person you trust be trustworthy. It also requires that we understand how the thing we're trusting, in this case science or scientists, comes up with the ideas it shares with us. And so there are some people who I think trust science very strongly. And we did find that those people are, you know, people who are in what we call the scientific profile, they uniformly totally disbelieved the 5G narrative. You know, they said, you know what, COVID-19 definitely didn't come from 5G. But at the same time, when it came to a statement like COVID is no more dangerous than the flu, even those people would say a 2 or 3 out of 7 instead of a 1, where 1 is, you know, no belief at all. And so what we see there is measures of uncertainty, which is that even if you believe very strongly in science, you can, you know, science itself is a process. And so we always acknowledge, you know, that something is almost certainly true, but other things, you know, are not impossible. They're just highly improbable. And so science people in the science profile generally very strongly believed that that narrative that's based on scientific evidence. Other people, again, they weren't necessarily disbelieving that. It's just they were thinking about it in different ways, and they didn't necessarily trust that scientists were telling the truth, or that they don't necessarily, if you see a scientist change their mind in response to evidence, it's not necessarily clear to some people that that's not, you know, quote unquote, flip-flopping rather than responding appropriately to new evidence that contradicted an older hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia, I want to ask you, and we can get more into it after our break, but, you know, the most obvious question I think a lot of people have is about the vaccine right now and when they're going to get it. We've seen a lot of problems come up with the distribution in different parts of the state. How do you think things are going with that right now?
You know, as of today, about 630,000 Hoosiers, or almost 10% of Hoosiers, have gotten at least one vaccine, and about 2.5% have gotten are fully vaccinated at this point. And I think having a centralized registration platform through the State Department of Health and centralized scheduling has actually gone pretty well in our state. And I know we generally feel like vaccination can't happen fast enough. However, you know, I have parents in Texas, and I can compare how we're doing to how they're doing. And it's, quite frankly, we're doing much better. And, you know, they're having to call around and drive 2 or 3 hours to get a vaccine. And each place has its own scheduling process. So the fact that we have this centralized hub for scheduling has helped us organize quite well. So I know it doesn't feel like it's fast enough. Mm-hmm. However, I think in the big picture, the state has done a good job in their vaccine rollout. And part of the vaccine rollout is making sure that we're targeting initially the individuals at highest risk. We started with healthcare workers and frontline workers.
Yeah.
Of course, these people often are younger, myself included.
Well, Cynthia, I'm going to stop you right there, but we're going to be right back. You can finish that. I also have a question from a listener that I want to direct her way. But we will be right back with our guest after a quick break. We're getting some updates on the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Well, we're talking today about the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Some of the questions that we got from our audience today came through the Indiana two-way text group, and you can join that group by texting Indiana to 732-24. Your comments and questions in response to our weekly Thursday morning texts help us find the answers that you need on COVID-19 and other statewide issues. We're joined by three guests. We have Shandy Dirth, a lecturer and director of undergraduate epidemiology education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also, John Egley is the associate professor at the Indiana University School of Public Health at IU Bloomington, and Cynthia Brown, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome back, everyone. And Cynthia, I'm sorry I had to cut you off there earlier, right before the break. You were talking about the vaccine right now, and a lot of people have a lot of questions about the vaccine and when they're going to get it. And if you can kind of revisit about a little bit some of the problems that have come up with just the distribution in different parts of the state.
I think when I think about how we're doing with distribution across the state, I think our more rural areas have fewer options, and their appointments for vaccination end up filled up faster. We're currently looking at individuals 65 and older, which are, of course, the highest risk populations. And hopefully we'll be able to get more vaccine delivered to the state, because I think that's sort of the biggest factor in going forward, is how quickly can we get additional vaccines delivered to us. And hopefully, you know, with the more recent plans that we're hearing from the national government, there will be an increased speed. In fact, just in the past couple of days, they've announced that some vaccines will be going to local pharmacies, which might also help speed up distribution around the state.
Yeah, and that brings me to a comment that we got from a listener about this, who says that teachers, people with medical conditions, and essential workers are continuing to ask when, you know, their turn will arrive. What can we say to people who are asking this question right now? You say that it's going to be, what do you think, weeks, months still?
I think weeks. You know, the people included in that group, teachers, people with chronic health conditions that put them at higher risk but don't meet the age categories, and essential workers, they generally fall in Indiana's phase 1B plan. So their time is coming. And I think it's really hard to be patient, right? There's a lot of fear around the potential for complications. And while we know that our oldest are our most vulnerable, not a day goes by that we don't see a story about someone who is young and otherwise healthy who comes down with a severe case of the disease. While that's rare, we want to make sure that people across the state have good availability of vaccine. But I think, you know, like I said, it really does come down to how fast are we getting the vaccines to us. Right now, we only have the messenger RNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna available. But it's every week, it seems like there's new information, and hopefully some new vaccines will be able to be reviewed by the FDA soon to also further increase our vaccine availability, such as Johnson & Johnson, Novavax, and potentially in the next few weeks, maybe even AstraZeneca will have positive results from studies.
I covered the opening of the mass distribution vaccine site in Fishers last week, and the health officials there were saying that they had the capacity to vaccinate up to 1,200 people, but they just need the vaccine, so they're just waiting on the more vaccine to get to their areas. I would imagine that's the case for a lot of places that are doing the vaccines.
That's very true. That's really what we're waiting on. We have a good distribution plan, I believe, within the state in general, but we have to get the vaccine to us in order to be able to make those distributions. And that is largely beyond our control. That's at the federal level, mm-hmm. of being able to have that vaccine to be distributed to us.
Shandy, you've been on All In a number of times, but just to remind our listeners, what work have you been doing around contact tracing?
So right now I'm the principal investigator on a contract with the city of Indianapolis and the Marion County Public Health Department. And so the health department has worked with Fairbanks for us to employ contact tracers to work in Marion County, so the Indianapolis area. So right now we're receiving the case reports directly from the Indiana Department of Health, and we call or sometimes visit those cases inside Marion County who have tested positive for COVID-19. And then that's how we get that close contact information as well during that interview. And then sometimes we also connect these people with social service agencies that they need, perhaps direct them to additional testing sites if other members of their families need to be tested, and other resources they might need, like a link to a food bank, something like that.
Mm-hmm. We've heard from some people around the state that they've faced some pretty big challenges around contact tracing. Have you seen things improve or change in any way since you've been working on it?
I think one advantage that we have here in Indianapolis is that we actually have the manpower to send someone to someone's front door if they don't answer the call. And I think that really emphasizes how important the public health director in Marion County sees contact tracing and the response to COVID-19. And so it's true, getting people to answer a phone number that they don't recognize is always difficult. I'm sure most of us here on the call don't like to answer those calls if you don't recognize that phone number. But we've done a lot of work with communications on trying to get the word out there that answer the call, answer the door. We need to talk with you about this information. And again, we keep emphasizing that we're not sharing anyone's PHI on these conversations. When you identify a close contact, we follow up with that close contact and let them know they've been in contact with someone who's positive for COVID-19. But we don't share that person's name or information, anything like that. And all of the information that we're collecting is helping us identify clusters, identify possible sources of transmission. And that data too has shown us that schools are okay to open. You can open schools safely. We haven't seen a lot of transmission within those buildings. So the people who have opened up with us and given us that information, they're the people who are helping us move forward and get the state reopened.
Do you see that it's still challenging though to get, like you said, some people just do not respond. Is that having a big impact right now, or is it still you're able to get that data that you think that we need?
I mean, I would love to have 100% of the data, 100% mm-hmm. of the people respond. And unfortunately, we just know that's probably not realistic. But again, we're going to keep working at it until we no longer need to do it, because and we encounter this in other things in public health where people don't want to respond to us or respond to our surveys. But it's one of those times where it's really critical. We make multiple attempts. So we often will call or text or visit a home several times, depending on availability of staff and what kind of caseload we have for the day.
What about just in general? You talked about earlier about just trying to get the word out in communication. What else can you do?
I think what's important is that if you have been in contact with the health department who's done contact tracing, let your friends and family know, you know, what the process was, so it's not some big mystery of what happens. But also, we ask everyone, if you've had COVID-19, go ahead and share that information with your friends and family if you're comfortable doing so, to let them know that, you know, they may have been exposed and that they need a quarantine at home. And every county still has free testing available. I think a lot of people still don't realize that there is free testing available. So you don't have to go through your physician's office. You don't have to pay for any kind of testing out of pocket. You can actually go to your local health department and get testing here in Indiana.
All right. Well, Shandy, we have another listener question that I want to direct toward you. This is one about the testing. They ask, why aren't more counties telling people to get tested more often? And then wouldn't that confirm either more or fewer cases to affect the percentage? I know this is kind of a detailed thing, but could also identify positive with no symptoms to avoid, you know, like you mentioned, unknowingly spreading COVID.
Yes, I've got to say the more testing, the better. So basically, if you have got the resources to go out to a community and do more testing, we kind of call that mitigation testing in public health, where you're testing people, not just those who are symptomatic or who have been identified as close contacts, but the more people you can test, the better handle you can get on the situation. Unfortunately, here in Indiana, we have not funded public health very well over several decades, and so we just don't have some of the resources here in Indiana that you've seen in some other larger cities or other states that have funded public health to do that. And so the local health departments are doing the best they can with the resources that they have. And I'm sure they would be happy to offer even more testing if they had more staff and more capability to do so. They're just kind of strangled with that right now.
Some employers test once or twice a week. Is that helping or hurting the percentage?
I think it helps because it's helping us find those cases and it stops from that percentage from going up. So I know working for Indiana University, they've got regular mitigation testing, not just for the students, but for the staff and faculty. And the fact that they've been so aggressive in the testing, it really has helped keep that under control on the campus. And so we've been able to keep classrooms open. We're able to go into this next semester pretty confident in our ability to keep it controlled.
John, when you were talking a little bit earlier about the research paper that you put out, I still find it very interesting in a lot of what people believe or they don't believe. How do you think Indiana compares to other states when it comes to, we talked about trust in science. Do you think Indiana is pretty on par with what other states are dealing with as well?
Yeah, let me answer it this way. I don't have any Indiana specific data, but I would suspect based on what I've seen, but I can't definitively say that Indiana is probably right around where other areas are. You know, misinformation is not necessarily something that is, I mean, you may have different ideas that pop up regionally, but it's something that's fairly widespread. A surprising number of people report that at least, you know, one of these pieces of misinformation is believable to them. There was one study, not mine, but another group did a study. They estimated that maybe as much as 80 to 85% of people they surveyed nationally believed at least one piece of misinformation. And so I think Indiana is probably no better or no worse than anywhere else. It's just, this is a fairly ubiquitous problem. But again, I don't mm-hmm. know definitively. It's just my speculation.
Right. When did you start putting that paper together?
It originated actually last year. You know, a lot of us were just at work one day, and then the next day we weren't. And it was this
like
big
so many
shock.
Of us.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was this experience of sitting at home in March, and for the first time, I was seeing epidemiology and public health talked about in the national news in a way that I had not seen in my lifetime. You know, this was, you know, there was the opioid epidemic and things like that. They got a reasonable amount of national attention, but this was, you know, this was the time that public health was really everywhere. And so I thought to myself, well, you know what? Maybe people are going to start trusting science and understanding public health better. And I was really excited about that. But because I am who I am, I was like, well, I'm going to do a quick study and see if my suspicion is correct. So surveyed a couple hundred people and found that actually that trust in science really hadn't budged between December and March, December 2019 and March 2020. So that led to this next step where, you know, over the summer, now I'm thinking, well, this trust thing seems to matter a lot when I started looking into it more. And so I wonder if trust is associated with believing in misinformation. And lo and behold, at least in this first study I did, it was really significantly associated. I mean, it was really surprising the degree to which it was. Because we've seen – oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say we've seen these other studies that they say, you know, being on an extreme end of the political spectrum on either side, you know, has been associated in other studies with believing misinformation as well as, you know, different kinds of cognitive processes and stuff. But again, when we put all that into the same model, at the end of the day, trust was by far – the most powerful predictor, at least in the model we came up with.
Do you think, though, the trust factor may come into play as far as the source of the information? A lot of people, maybe they're not really listening to science and the experts. They're listening to information that they're getting from maybe social media or just in the media in general. Do you think that has a role to play in whether or not they
absolutely.
Believe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct. You know, most of us have probably heard of the concept of echo chambers, you know, where especially with social media algorithms that drive traffic to things that are like other things you've seen, it's very easy to fall into a pattern where everything you see in social media is reflecting things that you already think and believe. Now, the interesting thing is we talk about echo chambers all the time as it relates to political echo chambers or, you know, maybe a conspiratorial echo chamber. But there's also evidence that there's a science echo chamber. And I think that's probably a huge problem because scientists go off in their own echo chamber and they share their findings with each other. But in doing so, there's not necessarily bridges between, you know, science networks and people who are just kind of discussing things more generally. And so I think, yes, the echo chamber effect is demonstrably real, but it also applies to science. And so I think, you know, for people like me, you're not going to sit down and listen to me talk for 30 minutes for fun necessarily about, about something like this, because, you know, I get lost in the ideas. Science really needs to work to demystify what it's doing and to communicate ideas, not at a more basic level, but in a way that is understandable and that can make headway into these other vertices of discussion.
I think that's key. You know, I think I find science extremely fascinating, but you have to make it understandable to people to be able to feel, I think, comfortable. I mean, sometimes, you know, scientists can maybe talk above someone else's head and it doesn't really all make sense. And so you kind of put it in general terms, but just to make it more understandable, I think that might help.
Yeah. And I think this is a lesson we can take as scientists from a lot of different fields. You know, a good example is I have kind of a unique upbringing in that my father both has a doctorate degree, but also was raised on a dairy farm. So I had a very kind of foot in both worlds upbringing. Mm-hmm. And so when he teaches me something like putting in window framing and putting up drywall and those kind of things, the complexity with that is the same complexity as the scientific research. Yes. But he has a really good way of explaining and teaching what that looks like. And yeah. I think that explanatory power is something that we really need to invest in the science community.
Sounds good. All right. Well, we'll be back. We have some listener questions. We'll take a quick break, and we're getting updates on the COVID-19 pandemic with a live panel of health experts today. If you have questions or comments for our guests, please give us a call. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. I'm back now to our discussion on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. As always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. A great panel of guests today. Shandy Dirth is a lecturer and the director of undergraduate epidemiology education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also, John Agley is associate professor at the Indiana University School of Public Health at IU Bloomington, and Cynthia Brown, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Cynthia, I have a question from a listener, and they want to know, can I choose which vaccine I get?
No, you cannot choose which vaccine you get at this time. All the vaccines available, as I mentioned earlier, the messenger RNA vaccines, but from Pfizer and Moderna. We hope to have different vaccines available from the Johnson & Johnson, which is a viral vectored vaccine, hopefully within the next month or so. The Novavax vaccine, which may also be looked at by the FDA within the next several weeks as well, has a different type of platform. But I think what I would like to reassure the listeners about is that regardless of the vaccine type, it's all of the vaccines that have been studied are highly effective at preventing severe disease across all the studies that have released data to date, whether it's the messenger RNA, the viral vector vaccines. They've had no associated hospitalizations among individuals who've gotten the vaccines and no deaths. So it's highly effective at preventing severe disease. I know it's really easy to let ourselves think about the vaccine efficacy numbers that come in. And I think I even heard Dr. Fauci or read something that Dr. Fauci said. Of course, if you read, do you want the vaccine that's 90% versus 70 or 80%, you're going to choose that 90% one. But you can't really directly compare the trials between Pfizer and Moderna, for instance, with Johnson & Johnson, because they're done at two different time points in the year with different circulating disease, potentially different circulating variants. So I think as a community, we need to trust the science, believe that we're preventing severe disease and hospitalizations. And if we can take this disease and turn it from something that's keeping our hospitals and ICUs full and leading to, you know, such a high excess mortality to something that's really mild, then we've done an excellent job. And we really need to just thank science for the speed with which we've been able to get these highly effective vaccines available to the public.
Yeah, well, it goes back again to what we were just talking about, is just trusting the science. I think maybe you have a lot of people still are questioning, you know, how effective the vaccine is and where there'll be any side effects to it that could harm them.
Yeah, the side effects are, of course, a big issue and the concerns there. And throughout this, one of the things that I've heard frequently is, hasn't this been developed too quickly? Do we know enough information to know about side effects? And when I think about the title Operation Warp Speed, I think sometimes that title in and of itself engendered a degree of vaccine mistrust, because it almost makes you feel like, are they going to be cutting corners to try to get this out there quickly? But the reality is that Operation Warp Speed really just refers to the fact that the government put up a lot of funding in order to begin manufacturing before we even knew these vaccines were effective or not. The side effects usually present really early. Now, certainly it's possible when you go from a trial with many tens of thousands of people enrolled to, once we're giving it to 100,000, a million or more people even per day, some very rare but serious side effects could pop up. For instance, the allergic reactions that some people have had to these vaccines. In a trial, you're not gonna typically enroll someone who has a high propensity to have allergies. So it's, in some respects, it's not a surprise that we see a few rare side effects. But now we're giving these vaccines around the country to more than a million people per day, and we're not seeing any significant serious side effects.
Another question about the vaccine, Cynthia, from that same listener. They ask, my doctor told me to get a certain company's vaccine. So when signing up, how can I verify I will receive that one? And then how do you find out what location has what vaccine?
I don't know that there is a way to know that at this point in time, which vaccines that you would be signing up for. It really depends upon availability.
So just, yeah, like we mentioned earlier, is who's got the vaccine?
Who's got the vaccine, yeah. But there's no way to know up front right now.
So a lot of people are wondering, too, about the new strains of the virus and what that could mean in our efforts to fight it. We have one question from a listener who asked, does the vaccine address the new type of COVID-19 strain?
I think we're still learning that. Some of the early research says that there is some reactivity against the strain seen in the UK for the different types of vaccines, perhaps less reactivity for the South African strain. I think the interesting and nice thing about our vaccine platforms is that they can be altered relatively quickly. And you're already seeing reports that Pfizer and Moderna think that they could be able to tweak their vaccine pretty easily to capture some of these new strains. But I think these are things that we need to learn about over the coming weeks and months. And hopefully we get ahead and get more people vaccinated to really just start decreasing the amount of circulating virus and prevent further mutations within the virus.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of great questions today from listeners, and it's just probably impossible to get to all of them. But Cynthia, I have another one that I want to direct your way about the process to get vaccinated. I've not heard about this one. They ask about the standby list. Are they happening? And then how can I get on one? Again, you know, I guess it goes back to the availability of the vaccine, but...
And I think you need to look at your county's health department. For instance, Fishers is a city that has a standby list. So you can register for standby lists, but you'll need to look either at your city or county health departments to see if they have something available.
Okay. All right. John, I go back to the research that you're doing. I just find it fascinating. Are you going to do some additional research?
Yeah, absolutely. So the next step, which is in process right now, is to answer the question, well, is there a way you can actually, at a broad level, support trust in science and then actually measure whether you've had an effect? And the way we're going to try to do that is through infographics. So we really dug into what are the different parts of reasons people might not trust the scientific process. So we looked at things like, you know, when one scientist disagrees with five other scientists, how do they resolve that dispute? Is that resolution public? You know, is there a perception that when a finding changes that there's a problem? Is there a general question about how do we know what we know? And can we address those kind of underlying beliefs with just, you know, an infographic or a internet comic or a meme or something like that? So what we're doing is actually developing a series of like short, you know, one page, you know, 3 to 5 panel web comics. And we're going to test those and see if we can actually, if showing those to people changes the degree to which they trust science. Now, that's a heavy lift to ask of a, you know, you're looking at a one page thing, 3 frames, and then you're seeing if something changed. So we don't think there's going to be much change from something like that. But if we can get just a little change, then do it on a broad scale, I think that would be good. And it's very important for us that we're not just putting random things together. It's important, you know, from the perspective of being trustworthy, everything in those panels also has to be absolutely true. You know, we can't exaggerate. We can't fall to what's called white hat bias. We actually have to present things about science that are true explanations, and then see whether any of those things change the way people think. And if they do, then we may be onto something that could form the basis of a, you know, media campaign or something like that.
Hmm. What about some element of the pandemic and how we responded to it? Do you think that needs to be studied more?
I mean, there's this is, you know, people were talking about the 1918 flu pandemic for a reason. This is something, this event's going to be something that's going to be studied in all likelihood for, you know, most of our lifetimes in some capacity, because it's a rare global catastrophe that and there's tons of information related to the pandemic, related to the way people have thought about it, the effects related to mental health, substance use. It's just, it's so complex that I think you'll see people looking into things like this, the way different countries have responded, the way perceptions have been talked about in social media. It's just going to be, you know, it's a complex set of information that people will be examining for probably the rest of my life.
Right. When you do your research, do you look at a certain population, a certain area of the state?
It depends. The most recent study I did, which I haven't published yet, so we haven't talked about that today. I've started trying to get nationally representative data, you know, that can be more readily generalized to the United States as a whole. I've seen other researchers do the same thing in Canada and the UK and Australia, for example. So I think there's value in knowing what people are thinking in Indiana, so we can communicate more effectively within the state. And then there's also value in knowing at a broader level what people are thinking. So I think it's both. Mm-hmm. You do within state surveys, and then you also do larger studies.
And Shandy, I wanted to get back to you on just as far as how you think we're doing with the contact tracing again, and what do you see coming up this year? Anything different that the state or Marion County will be doing with that?
Well, I think one thing we're aware of is with the transmission of the variants going through the United States, we do expect somewhat of a bump again in March. And so that's why we're really hopeful that we can get more people vaccinated that much faster. And just a quick point about the vaccine too. One thing I tell my students when they ask the same question, which vaccine should I get? Mm-hmm. I remind them that the annual influenza vaccine that we take every year ranges anywhere typically between 40 and 60% efficacy. And we see that flu vaccine has a tremendous impact on the amount of flu that we see every year. So having something that's 95% effective is not very common, actually. So don't hesitate to wait and try and get that 95, or I'm sorry, don't hesitate to get a vaccine when you're eligible. Just take the vaccine that you can get for COVID-19. There's not really a need to try and wait and get one of the 90, 95% vaccines, because again, as Cynthia said, those numbers are kind of fluid a little bit in how they do the clinical studies. And we know something 40 to 60% does great for us with flu.
So you mentioned another bump in March. Are we anticipating another big spike?
We're anticipating an increase. It seems like this is kind of the quiet before the storm. And so CDC has modeled that the variants will become more common across the U.S. by March. And so the concern is that some of these variants are more contagious. And we know sometimes in March, we start to see a little more spring break activity, more travel activity, that sort of thing. So we are concerned. And again, many of the states are still in colder weather. People are indoors. They're huddled around more people who are not living within their household. So we're still worried about transmission. Again, we're not out of the woods. So we still need to follow those social distancing guidelines and be very careful until we can get a much larger percentage of the population vaccinated.
It seems like this time of year or late last year, we're always talking about, or we were talking about the flu. Is that a big problem that you know of right now?
The flu is almost non-existent. And so, I mean, there's been a little bit out there, but the great benefit, you know, if you've got to find a silver lining in a pandemic is that we've had very little flu. So the hand washing, the social distancing, the mask wearing, that has affected so many other infectious diseases that we typically see this time of year. So we've seen huge improvements for public health in those other areas.
Well, maybe not worry about the flu, but then you were talking about all the different variants of this virus that we have to be concerned about.
Correct.
Yeah. So as far as the testing, I mean, again, do you think that's just it's going to happen in time for everyone? As far as getting tested, getting that vaccine?
Well, again, we've got plenty of testing right now. We're not seeing that many people get tested. So there's definitely testing capacity out there.
Okay.
We just need to encourage everyone to get tested. So if you've had someone that you've been around tell you that they've tested positive, go ahead and get tested yourself. Because again, we see a large percentage of people never show any symptoms and yet they have COVID. And I'm sure no one wants to be that person that who accidentally gives a family member or a friend COVID. And again, it's Super Bowl weekend this Sunday. I encourage everyone to stay home and watch the game and eat their favorite junk food with members of their own household. You know, we can all root against Tom Brady inside our own house. We don't need to be around other people possibly spreading COVID.
Right. How's the rural counties doing with the contact tracing?
The rural counties are relying more on the state Department of Health for the contact tracing. And so they're still using the Maximus call center. So that's primarily phone-based. It's usually the larger health departments who have taken in some more resources to do additional contact tracing.
As far as, you know, the challenges they're facing, is there any unique challenges there?
In the rural areas?
Mm-hmm.
I think what we've seen a lot of times in the rural area, again, is just the access to care. So they have more limited places to go get tested, more limited opportunities to get the vaccine. As we've seen, some of the rural places are reporting that they are booking people 5-6 weeks out to get that second dose, or sometimes even their first dose right now that we've opened up some of these other age ranges. And so what we're seeing is sometimes people are traveling from the more rural areas to the more urban areas to get an earlier vaccination date.
All right. Well, let's hope for more vaccines and that eventually this will all become a memory.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank all of you today for taking the time to join us. There's just a lot of information, and I appreciate your time. I want to again thank Shandy Durth, a lecturer and the director of undergraduate epidemiology education. That's at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Also, John Adgley is associate professor at the Indiana University School of Public Health at IU Bloomington, and Cynthia Brown, an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Again, thank you all for being here. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer, and he composed our theme song. If you would like a podcast of this show or really any past show, you can find it anywhere that you get your podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks so much for listening. This is All In.